We'll hear argument next in number 20-1055, In Re Sabin. Mr. Vidopia.
Thank you. In his opening briefs, in his opening reply briefs, before the board, appellant Robert Sabin presented two arguments. The first is that the board failed to properly construe the claims to include certain limitations in the preamble and body, which distinguish both the primary 103 reference, Sabin 082, and the secondary reference to Frey. The second argument is that appellant indeed overcomes the presumption of obviousness under the holding of Peterson, as the board ignored the evidence that Frey's range is so broad that it does not invite routine optimization. If you recall, that broad was 7 by 10 to the minus 4 grams to 7 grams per day for a 70-kilogram person. Appellant first argued that the board failed to properly construe Claim 6 to include the limitations in the preamble and body. And those limitations, the missing limitation in the preamble and in the body, is to effectively treat Alzheimer's disease and related amyloid plaque development and reduction of amyloid plaque, protein aggregation, and amyloid doses. And had the board considered and construed the claims properly, these two limitations would have, in the preamble and in the body, would have distinguished Sabin 082 and Frey separately and in combination. The examiner first and then the board after him failed to consider the missing limitations when it construed the claims, and this is fatal error because all the words in the claims are important, as suggested by Amgen.
This is Judge Toronto. Why isn't there a very large forfeiture problem? I mean, when you say the examiner and then the board failed to do something, it's a little awkward to say they failed to do something that they were not asked to do. And am I remembering right that you did not a claim construction position that said the various words after the and after Alzheimer's disease required something more?
Well, in appellant's brief before the board, the appellant presented all of the claims, including those limitations, the first office action issued, and the examiner proposed a prima facie case of obviousness where he presented those claims and didn't argue the limitations. And I think it started from there. What occurred, though, is that in the reply brief before the board, appellant did raise the issue. The board's September 12, 2019 decision did not address the fact that appellant in his reply brief raised the issue where 37 CFR 44.41B2 sets out that a new argument can be raised in a reply brief for good cause, and a proper construction of these claims, we believe, is good cause. The board should have remanded the case back down to the examiner. These limitations were significant. They're the heart of the case. They come from the Oregon studies. The Oregon studies verified that this treatment in the claimed range is efficacious.
This is Judge Moore. If I understand your argument, it was you can always raise a new argument in your reply brief for the first time for good cause, and your only explanation of why this is good cause is claim construction is always good cause because it's important to construe the claims properly. If I'm understanding that argument, you're saying as a matter of law across the board, claim construction can always be raised for the first time in reply brief and the board is forced to address it.
No, Your Honor. I'm not going that far as to make that presumption. What occurred is that in the examiner's reply brief, the issue was raised. please, pardon me for one moment. I believe it was page 24 of the examiner's brief. At APPX 11, the examiner stated that at most appellant's evidence elucidates the mechanisms by which phytic acid may be effective in alleviating symptoms of Alzheimer's disease by providing protection against APPC99-mediated toxicity, enhancing cytochrome oxidase, which is mitochondrial function, goes to mitochondrial function, or suppressing malondialdehyde or lipid peroxidation. The results of this, of the treatment, of the claimed treatment, realizes these effects. And they were, again, brought up by the examiner in his response to the appellant's opening brief before the board, and I believe it may very well, it suggests that that this is an issue before the board. And then again, in the reply brief before the board, appellant raised the issue directly. I'm not suggesting that one can avoid raising an argument in their brief and then raise it in the reply brief without good cause, but what I'm suggesting is that this is indeed a good cause, because these limitations come from the studies, and there's just no way that these claims can be properly construed and then an obviousness analysis conducted unless they include these limitations.
Counsel, time is short, and why don't we just suppose we accept your argument that these are not waived. Why don't you tell us why you think these preamble terms are limiting? You referenced In Re Fought, which, yes, I remember, and in that case, there was actually antecedent basis in the claim body for the limitation, the preamble. I mean, antecedent basis, it referred back to the preamble for antecedent basis. And so that is a significant difference, I think, between that set of facts and this set of facts. So what is your best argument for why we ought to interpret this preamble language as not a statement of intended use, but rather an actual structural limitation?
Because the body of the claim refers back to it. The body
at
the end of claim 6, it says being administered an amount of 0.5 grams to about 18.75 grams per day to effectively treat Alzheimer's disease and related amyloid plaque development and reduction of amyloid plaque protein aggregation and amyloidosis. So the clause is repeated in the body of the claim, preceded by the phrase to effectively treat, and it's articulated in the preamble before the consisting essentially of. So I believe it is tied to the preamble. The body of the claim is tied to the preamble. So I think that
if you think the limitation is repeated in that portion of the body of the claim about effectively treat Alzheimer's disease, why do you need the preamble?
Well, you know, it's not quite repeat. I mean,
it isn't quite repeated, and it doesn't actually use antecedent basis. Antecedent basis is a very specific patent prosecution concept where you refer back by saying the as opposed to an. You know, it's very precise in patent jargon. This isn't antecedent basis. If anything, it's restating it in a slightly different way, which would therefore imply the preamble is not, in fact, a limitation.
I see that it's tied back. I mean, it says 0.5 grams to about 18.75 grams per day to effectively treat Alzheimer's disease, dot, dot, dot.
No, it doesn't have a dot, 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 but okay, go ahead.
Well, sorry. To effectively treat Alzheimer's disease and related amyloid plaque development and reduction of amyloid plaque, protein aggregation, and amyloid
So, so why isn't that by itself the full portion of the structure of the claim? Why? What about that makes you think it is referring back for antecedent basis, which is a technically precise concept to the preamble?
Because it's introduced in the preamble, then it's tied together with the to effectively treat.
But why isn't the to effectively treat complete in its own structure? Why do you have to look back to the preamble?
It may be, Judge. I was responding to the solicitor's position. I believe that the claim clearly requires construction to include the expression to effectively treat Alzheimer's disease and related amyloid plaque development and reduction of amyloid plaque protein aggregation and amyloidosis. I mean, that was our point, Judge. I'm not sure if I'm being clear here.
Okay, anything further, Mr. Rodopia? Anything further?
Yes. The second, appellant's second argument.
You're into your rebuttal time.
Oh, I wonder, can I have some of that time back?
You can use it all now if you wish.
No, the time in the first 10 minutes. We got sort of sidetracked with that limitation, and I was hoping to present that second argument. Okay, let me get into it. Appellant's brief, essentially, in our understanding, there's no reason that the skilled artisan would have looked to Frey to modify what's taught by Sabin 082, the primary reference. We don't see that Frey's invented a method of treating Alzheimer's disease. Looking at Frey's paragraph 5, which is the appendix page 1084, Frey says that the invention provides methods for enhancing cellular function protection of tissue components, where 5 says the invention provides a method protecting muscarinic acetylcholine receptors and increasing the efficacy of an agent that directly or indirectly affects an MACHR. Essentially, he mentions in several of the paragraphs Alzheimer's disease as an afterthought. I mean, he articulates in paragraph 12, first, that the method of treating muscarinic acetylcholine receptors can treat or prevent in paragraph 12 that it can treat or prevent a CNS disorder, but it goes into all these diseases that are about 90% of all the diseases known to man: Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, Lewy body dementia, multiple sclerosis, tumors in the brain and spinal cord, prion diseases, spinal cord injuries. I mean, and then paragraph 13 goes into blood diseases, neuropathies. He just goes on and on, and so we don't believe that there's any really written description support for treating Alzheimer's disease, even though appellant's initial and reply brief articulated it in terms of enablement under 112A. There doesn't appear to be any support at all for treating Alzheimer's disease. He goes through 4 examples beginning on page APPX 1062, and all of them are just hypothetical. The examples talk about the ability in the art to verify the efficacy of his invention of treating MACHRs, but his examples show no results. They do not even verify the treatment of MACHRs, let alone provide any kind of data to try to tie successful treatment of MACHRs to any kind of CNS disorder, let alone Alzheimer's disease. There's nothing in Frey to indicate that MACHRs somehow affect Alzheimer's disease. The best he had was example 1, which is paragraph 109, again, of APPX 1094, And what that articulates is that pyrophosphate protects the MACA pyrophosphate, not the inventive inositol hexaphosphate, which has got six phosphates. Pyrophosphate protects the MACA from inactivation of the LMW inhibitor or by the combination of heme and peroxide. And that's in figures one. You know, there's just nothing to tie, for example, the results shown in figure one with pyrophosphate to inositol hexaphosphate affecting Alzheimer's disease or amyloid precursor protein, et cetera. And that's pretty much our argument. We don't see that Frey truly invented it. And so I just want to end with the fact that Frey, this was a pending application, Frey, and Frey issued a patent. Excuse me, I have about 10
seconds. Mr. Vidopia, we're out of time. We'll restore 1 minute of your rebuttal.
Okay, and I will save it till then. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We'll hear from Ms. Queller.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Substantial evidence supports the obviousness of the claimed method over the prior art of Sabin and Frey. Appellant was already granted a patent, the Sabin patent, an almost an identical method step, which was the oral administration of phytic acid to Alzheimer's disease patients. So the Board correctly found that any difference in dose between what was disclosed in Sabin and the claims at issue here was rendered obvious by Frey's disclosure of doses that overlapped the claimed range for phytic acid and the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And appellant failed to overcome the presumption of obvious created by this overlap by a showing of either teaching away or unexpected results. I'll briefly address the discussion this morning regarding the amyloid plaque limitation. As Judge Toronto pointed out, there is a significant forfeiture issue here. As appellant admitted, they raised this for the first time in their reply brief to the Board, which under 37 CFR 41.41 is just simply too late.
Counsel, this is Judge Moore. Can I ask a question as point of clarification? Am I right in remembering that they never raised the amyloid plaque issue in the body of the claim, that the only thing they did in the reply brief was point to the preamble?
Let me look exactly. They say the answer does not account for each required claim limitation, and then they just quote the to effectively treat, so that is the body of the claim limitation, I believe, not the preamble. So they just, in their reply brief, referred to the body of the claim, not the preamble. And that's at Appendix 826, moving over to 827. It spans those two pages. So they did refer to the body of the claim, but that was the very first time that they mentioned this claim limitation in this one kind of sentence spanning two pages of the reply brief. There was nothing in the examiner's answer that was new. It was, the examiner's answer is almost completely identical to the final rejection at this in this case. So there was nothing in the examiner's answer that provided good cause under 41.41 to allow them to raise this issue at this point. So the Board properly did not consider it, and at that point it is waived. And they never filed a request for rehearing saying the Board misapprehended or overlooked anything. And I disagree with one of the statements by appellant's counsel that this is the heart of the case. You would think if it was the heart of the case, their appeal brief would have mentioned it. Instead, as we pointed out in the director's brief at page 28, we took out a number of statements from their appeal brief, which only focused on treating Alzheimer's disease, no mention of these amyloid plaque limitations. And even if you go back in prosecution, for example, I think a good example to look at is Appendix 614 to 617. So this is the response essentially right before the final rejection. And just over and over and over again throughout this, they only talk about Alzheimer's disease. For example, if you look at page 615, Appendix 615, they talk about applicant's invention is a standalone monotherapy for Alzheimer's disease. no mention of amyloid plaque. So I disagree with appellant's characterization of this amyloid plaque limitation as the heart of the case.
This is Judge Toronto. Can I ask a question that relates to your kind of second and third arguments about this plaque limitation? So put aside for the moment the question of forfeiture. You say that the body language of to effectively treat Alzheimer's and to do these other things is a statement of intended use. Have we really said that a limitation in a claim that uses the language to effectively treat something, and I guess it would also follow on and to effectively treat the disease and the related plaque development, that is a non-limiting statement of intended use because of the word to?
So I believe the closest cases would be the Bristol-Myers case and the Copaxone case. I think I'll start with the Copaxone case. In that case, the body of the limitation said, so to thereby treat the human patient, and then it continued on with a dose that they were going to give. And this court found that claim language did not have any bearing on the method being practiced. It did not change the steps. And the In Re Copaxone followed the Bristol-Myers case, which came to a similar conclusion again with respect
to the
limitation.
So I'm not remembering Copaxone or Bristol-Myers for that matter. So we ruled there that it was actually immaterial to if it were infringement or to prior art, whether there was actually an effective treating going on?
That's the understanding of those cases, yes. And I think the reason being is that there was no change in the dosing based on that limitation. So the claim itself had a dose, as this claim does, had a dose already. What you were going to effectively treat did not change the dosing recited by the claim. And so it really was just an extra statement of intended use or intended results for the claim that did not change any of the manipulative steps and did not really make a difference in any of the method steps of the claims in both those cases as similar to this case. And so I think those are the two that are closest here. And as Your Honor, Judge Moore pointed out in Ray Fought, we've distinguished that in our brief. In addition to the antecedent basis issue, the travel trailer language in that case was also deemed limiting because it added structural requirements, it adding a living area requirement and a towability requirement that was a structural difference, not just a statement of intended results. Here, the amyloid plaque limitations are just statements of what they hope to achieve or what they'd like to achieve with the administration, not changing any of the steps of the method.
But counsel, this is Judge Moore. Following up on this line of questioning, why isn't the to effectively treat Alzheimer's disease or to effectively treat amyloid plaque development relevant to the amount that you would actually administer? This is a large range, 0.5 to 18.75 grams. So why isn't that subsequent limitation effective as to the amount within that range that you would need to use for any given patient?
I think that's an excellent question, Your Honor. We presented in our brief that we did believe this was a statement of intended results. However, this may be one reason why, if the court does not find this issue waived, there are some factual questions that should be addressed, and therefore it would be most prudent to remand to the board. We put this briefing in our brief just for completeness sake, but because it was waived and the board never addressed it and the examiner never addressed it, we do believe it is most prudent, if this court does not believe it was waived, to remand it for those sort of factual considerations and arguments to be raised and addressed by either the examiner or the board.
One problem that I have with the waiver argument is the board didn't find it waived. It just failed to address it.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the board's rules provide that they do not have to consider an argument that was not raised. So 4141 does provide the board's guidance on that, which appellant should have been aware of. And furthermore, I think also the fact that it was just one sentence spanning two pages at the very bottom stuck in after years of prosecution where this was never raised. I also would say that that was not sufficient really to put the board on notice that this was an issue, that they were supposed to address it. The skeletal one sentence argument really did not adequately put the board on notice of this argument that they were supposed to address. So it's understandable that the board responded to all the other arguments that they made in their appeal briefing and through the course of prosecution. And with respect to the fact, I believe appellant
this this one sentence wasn't sufficient to put them on notice, they actually added emphasis on page 827, and they say the examiner's answer failed to identify either where statement or phrase teach, and then they have the limitation, and they added emphasis to the and, which I think is a pretty clear signal that this is not just about Alzheimer's, that it avoids amyloid plaque reduction as well. How much more do you think they would have had to say for that not to, you say it's skeletally raised, so how much more would they have had to say?
I think one of the things they should have done is raise it in their appeal brief. So I think that is our main argument, is that their appeal brief over and over and over again
Isn't it correct that the board could find something not raised in the initial appeal brief waived and therefore not address it if it's only raised in reply for the first time?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But they did that. My problem is now I'm kind of circling back to what my problem was. The board didn't do that. So my problem is the board didn't conclude that it was waived. You're absolutely right that the board had the authority to conclude it was waived and may have done so, and maybe we would have reviewed that finding, but the board didn't find it waived. They just didn't address it. And under the APA, doesn't the board have an obligation to address all of the arguments that are raised?
Stepping back to your first point, I don't believe a party's waiver to this court depends on whether the board finds something waived in the reply brief. I don't know of any cases that have found that to be the case. The board...
Do you know of any cases where we have found an argument was waived because it was only raised in the reply brief, even though the board failed to address it at all?
No, I am not aware of one. I was not able to find one there. There are plenty of cases that affirm the board's finding of waiver.
Right. No, absolutely. And the APA requires the board to address every argument that's made. And so here we have an argument made about a claim limitation. Just drop the whole preamble thing because that, to me, was just noise. But we have an argument made about a particular claim limitation not being disclosed by the references. And we have the failure of the board to address it at all. Not only did they not address it on the merits, they didn't conclude it was waived. I don't know how that satisfies the APA, which requires the board to address with particularity all of the arguments made.
Well, I believe underlying the APA is that it's required to raise all the arguments properly raised. And I would argue that under 37 CFR 4141 and 37 CFR 4137, which also talks about the fact that arguments not included in the appeal brief will be refused consideration by the board. Both those two provide that this argument was not properly raised. And the board, with respect to a different issue regarding what claim was representative, but they did talk and cite 4137.
Does the board have the discretion I mean, we certainly have the discretion, right? Our court has the discretion to address an issue raised in a reply brief for a first time. We usually don't do so, but we have the discretion to do so. Does the board similarly have discretion to consider arguments raised for the first time in the reply brief, or is the rule absolute that they do not have the discretion?
So under the rule, appellants can come forward with good cause, and that the board can look at that and decide whether or not there is good cause and use its discretion to look at the argument. Appellants did not do so here. The first time that they mentioned good cause is in the reply brief to this court, which is just simply too late. So yes, the board does have discretion, but it's at appellant's urging that there is good cause, and no such position was stated here. I'd like to just, with my last about 40 seconds, just address the fact appellant's argument about the range not being too broad. Again, appellant, as with all of its briefing to the board and to this court, is really isolatingly talking about Frey alone and failing to consider the entire teachings of Sabin, which already tells you the dose, the type of administration, and the patient to give it to. Frey was directed to Alzheimer's disease. There was a discussion about Frey never talking about Alzheimer's disease. I'd just like to point the court to Appendix 1088, paragraph 56, where Alzheimer's disease is identified as the preferred treatment for this Frey publication. So if there's no more questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the board. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Vidopia, you have a minute.
Yes. You know, I just want to point out that Frey reference issued as a patent with two claims. The first is a method of treating muscarinic receptors in a subject having a CNS infection comprising meningitis by delivering an effective amount of pamidronate, which is a calcium uptake drug for use in cancer patients, by bypassing the blood-brain barrier by intranasally administering the upper one-third of the subject's nasal cavity, the effective amount of pamidronate, or pharmaceutically acceptable salt thereof. So treating the subject's muscarinic receptors that are affected. What Frey did was Mr. Frey rethought his initial disclosure during the prosecution of this case, and in March 7, 2010, modified the claims and made clear that systemic administration of the entire range of Frey, that is 7 milligrams to 7 grams, is problematic. And so he said, lower that dose and put it through the nose. And our position is that looking from Sabin 082, the skilled person would not have looked from Sabin 082 to Frey, because Frey has pretty much articulated that nasal administration is the way to go. The systemic administration, oral administration, is problematic, and there's no way that Sabin, which Sabin 082, which recommends 35 grams per day to 210 grams per day, would have looked to Frey to nasally administer a composition. How could you put
Mr. Vidopia, I think we're well over your time. Thank you very much. My colleagues have further questions.
Thank you.
And the case is submitted.
Thank you all.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.